the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a very special edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, delivered by podcast and originating in San Francisco. And today, we're going to talk about what's missing from the corporate media. Sure, lately we've gotten Tiger Woods, we got the Octomom, we got the Balloon Boy, we got more Sarah Palin than we know what to do with. But what about the news that really matters? In a moment, we'll be joined here in my secret studio by two of the key people from Project Censored. But first, I want to acknowledge people who support this program, Sherry Willoughby and Don Sisney. PayPal doesn't tell me where you're located, but I know you're there, and I appreciate your monthly subscriptions. If you'd like to help, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month, and every little bit helps.
Can't touch this. Can't touch this.
And we're trotting MC Hammer out of the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives.
Can't touch this.
Because the corporate media seems to be allergic to hard news, to the stories that really matter. And when you talk to producers and anchors and the suits behind the media empire, they say, oh, we can't touch that. Oh, we can't touch this.
I told you, homeboy.
But they can give us a lot of distracting tabloid media coverage, tips on weight loss, all kinds of stuff. But what about the stories that really matter? Peter Phillips is the outgoing executive director of Project Censored at Sonoma State University, and he's put in a lot of hours since Carl Jensen retired a few years back. Peter, welcome back to our program.
Thanks very much, Peter. This is my 13th year and 13th book, and we're passing it on.
Yeah, well, I think that's great, and we'll talk about the man who is going to take your place, Ben Frymer, a little bit later in the program. And Mickey Huff is with us as well. And he's been contributing to Project Censored for how long, Mickey? I haven't kept track.
Oh, several years. Peter and I have known each other since 2001, done a lot of conferences together, and I was associate director for Project Censored for over a year.
Mm-hmm. You're based at Sonoma State University, and it's a terrific service that you do for the nation and the world every year. And we're going to delve into the 25 stories. We're ambitious here. We're going to try to touch on at least a bit of each one of these stories and give people resources about where they can find out more information if they're curious. But I want to start off with something, Peter, that you first alerted us to. And I recall a year and a half ago, we all convened in Minneapolis for a media reform conference where free speech was not fully embraced, and that's a story in itself. But you were getting people to sign a petition about what you call a very serious problem, a media crisis, a media emergency in this country. Talk a little bit about that and what has changed in the last 18 months.
Well, in Minneapolis, we surveyed a solid 10% of the participants at that conference, and there was over 2,500 participants. So we had a statistical poll that put us in the 97 percentile of accuracy of what everybody thought. And what they're saying is, and they agreed to the statement, that we have a truth emergency in the United States. Mm-hmm. So this isn't just we got to reform media, they're not giving us the whole story. This is a real emergency in democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was I mean, so that the agreement there, and granted, these were media activists and people concerned with this topic,
right?
But it really legitimized that these conferences we've had have been kind of media reform. Let's get the FCC to change things. And that the constituency there attending these conferences is far more concerned with the loss of democracy in media and the public being informed, and mm-hmm. to the level that it is now an emergency in this country.
Yeah. And Mickey Huff, we see this compounded by the severe cutbacks at daily newspapers, which I think is very critical. A lot of beat reporters have been laid off. Huge cutbacks in the television industry. And they didn't do that much enterprise reporting to begin with. But it does mean there are fewer people to take the time to investigate important issues and bring them to the public's attention. Do you see us declining even further as we go forward?
Yeah, actually, unfortunately, I do. Downsizing, deregulation, and conglomeration are all major problems contributing to fewer journalists covering real hard news stories. And as Michael Nieman pointed out in the introduction to Censor 2010 this year, he wrote a great, great piece in the introduction called Die Zombie Newspapers Die. The dailies died a generation ago, and now their corpses are following suit. And, you know, Nieman goes through the whole litany of obituaries for newspapers. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know, some major papers, you know, in including the Rocky Mountain News, Cincinnati Post. I mean, some papers have been around for a long time.
Seattle PI,
right? We all know the mm-hmm. Chronicle has been struggling
in San Francisco.
That's uh-huh. right. And so, you know, really, and this ties into the truth emergency, and this ties into, you know, the direction that Peter and I have been going with writing and research and speaking, and that's that, you know, corporate news media just isn't in the business of news. And on the cover of this 2010 book this year, the image is very powerful. It's the image of empty newspaper dispensing machines. Mm-hmm. And it's very literal. No news. And that's what we mean. And when we have this crisis, this is a real crisis of democracy. We have fewer and fewer people able to get the word out to people about what's really going on in the country. And we have a hyper-real situation. I know we can talk about that a little bit later on. But it's a real serious problem.
And I don't have the attribution in front of me, but I recall seeing a story earlier this year published by an out-of-work, a laid-off, bought-out journalist who tried to estimate the number of stories that would go unreported because the human power, the manpower, has been reduced so sharply. And beat reporters who used to go out there and cover a certain topic or a certain government agency, they're a thing of the past. And we have people who basically just parachute in when news breaks, when scandal breaks, or when press releases are delivered.
And literally the press releases become the news. So that you have these public relation firms that have been just exploding in terms of numbers, preparing newscasts, preparing news stories, offering them to the corporate media, and the easiest thing to do is just use them.
Mm-hmm.
So it fills up with PR spun news that for companies that are working for government and corporations.
And one of the things that I see more commonly now, because I'm on a lot of PR distribution lists, is they supply free B-roll. And if people don't understand what B-roll is, watch a TV newscast, and the anchor is reading a story to you, and pictures pop up. And it's often file footage or, you know, things that they just dug up, or maybe even they sent a camera crew out there and got the crime scene or the news scene or whatever it is. But when an industry wants to propagandize, what they do is supply that B-roll to the television stations, and with the cutbacks and the reduction in standards, what we see is they're more than likely to use that because, gosh, TV news doesn't work without pictures. Right, Mickey?
Yeah, and it's a shame, too, that, you know, that could work both ways because, you know, you're certainly aware of, you know, the pictures of the dead soldiers and dead civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan that we're not allowed to see, and we're not allowed to see the coffins coming home, and we're not allowed to see these things. But there's no shortage of us, you know, being allowed to see Tyler Woods' SUV overturned, or, you know, images of Tyler Banks' shifting figure, and, you know, all this other tripe that's largely generated to grab eyeballs for advertisers. And this is just it's actually even more of a snowballing effect when you're talking about this B-rolling. type problem. And Peter was talking about the PR firms, and they're conglomerated as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're talking only a few now that basically control the whole situation.
MPP, Interpublic Group, Omnicom are massive public relations firms that have really allowed many of the big firms that we knew, Helen Nolan, they've merged, mm-hmm. and they're in every country in the world. Literally, they have 175,000 employees, and they'll package news stories. And if they're working for the Pentagon and they're in Baghdad, they'll package a story, supposedly from the Baghdad government, that says there's been 87,000 Iraqis killed in the last 5 years of the war, which mm-hmm. is absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, we have three national surveys done in Iraq, two by Johns Hopkins University, one by Opinion Business Research, and the most recent in 2007, they interviewed 2,400 families. This is a 97% accuracy rate for the size of the population mm-hmm. in Iraq, and they came up with 1 million civilians who have died because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
And it's massive. So it's deliberate counter information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that story was in The Nation. It was on Huffington Post. It was covered in independent media around the country. Corporate media won't touch it. They won't even touch it. Instead, AP comes up with a story a year ago, and then they re-released it three times this year. Mm-hmm. They re-released it in July, and they re-released it in October, saying 87,000 dead Iraqis. It's just absolute lie.
Yeah.
And that's why it was the number one story in the censored 2009 book mm-hmm. last year. Mm-hmm. That's just a crucial humanitarian cost of war that most Americans know nothing about. And when surveyed over a year ago, most Americans believe there to be fewer than 10,000 deaths as a result of the American occupation of Iraq. I mean, that's absolutely absurd. Talk about truth emergency. I mean, there's the concept in a nutshell.
And one of the people who I have repeatedly gone to get reality about Iraq is an independent journalist, Dar Jamail. And Dar wrote the introduction to the 2010 edition of the paperback book that is out from Project Censored. And he joins us now by phone. Dar, it's good to talk with you again.
Good to be with all three of you.
And Dar, just what we were just discussing a moment ago about Iraq and the civilian casualties, this is an issue where reporters and outlets in other parts of the world have embraced a more real number. But in the United States, we have our own set of stats and our own news that is shaped by the corporate media. And it's also massaged by very expert people in our government.
Right, and I don't think we could possibly get a more clear, concise explanation than what we just heard about how this happens and why it happens and what the truth is, as opposed to how it's being spun by corporate media in this country. And it is really amazing, because when you look overseas, a lot of the bigger news outlets there will at the very least cite the Lancet report, which was released in October of 2006, of 665,000 dead Iraqis as a result of the invasion and occupation. Of course, this study is grossly outdated and still far too low, but still, by comparison, dwarfs this bogus figure being released and regurgitated by the AP. Again, it's a really perfect example of the really insidious, level of lying and really the dehumanization of what's happening in Iraq and the lies and the propaganda being spread around to kind of minimize the devastation that the U.S. invasion and occupation have had on both the country and people of Iraq, where, you know, over 1 million dead, well over 1 million dead at this point, 1 in 6 still displaced from their homes, grinding poverty, just about 1 out of every 2. It's 45% of Iraqis living in abject poverty on less than $1 a day. I mean, this is a situation where it's far, far worse than even during the sanctions, which, of course, were typified by the Madeleine Albright comment when asked, do you think the sanctions, which are responsible for the deaths of at least 500,000 Iraqi children, are these worth the price to pay to contain Saddam Hussein? And her quip on 60 Minutes of, yes, we think the price is worth it. Well, the situation in Iraq now is far, far, far worse than that situation during the sanctions. And yet, here we are, you know, you ask the average person in this country today, and people probably think Santa Obama has ended the war and things are just great in Iraq.
Another product of massive spin is biting us right now. And that is the myth that the surge worked. The surge of U.S. troops into Iraq that Bush ordered, surprising us all after his Iraqi study group, after he dithered over exactly what course to take with his war of choice in Iraq. And now President Obama is embracing that myth to use as a basis for his argument to put more troops into Afghanistan. And in a preceding podcast, it's number 72, Robert Perry and Reese Ehrlich were with us and discussed that in some detail, so I won't go into it in great depth right now. But it is an example of how this kind of media spin can be used to really set us on a course that departs us further and further from reality, rational thinking, and basic truth. Peter?
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, we're really on a road where we don't know what's happening. It's kind of, if you watch corporate media, it's like being in Disneyland. And it's, you know, you're really there, but you don't know what, but you know it's not real.
Mm-hmm. And Dar, do you have any comment on that from your perspective as somebody who has been to Iraq many times? You published the book called Beyond the Green Zone as an unembedded journalist, and that's very different from much of what we've seen in the mainstream media in this country.
Well, exactly. I mean, I was just in Iraq again earlier this year and was shocked. It was my first time back there in 4 years since I did all the reporting that was in the book you just mentioned. And I went back to see how much things had changed, in the wake of all of this surge rhetoric and propaganda. Well, things are better, violence is down, et cetera, et cetera. And it's atrocious. I mean, there's kids walking around on the streets with distended bellies. You would think you were in some place in South Africa, in some of the impoverished countries there. There really is no security. People are afraid to leave their neighborhoods. As I said before, 1 in 6 people are displaced from their homes to this day. And those who have left the country altogether, nobody's coming back home. I mean, over 90% of those people who've left, according to the UN, intend to remain out of the country forever. I mean, this is a decimated, burnt-out country. There's nothing left. And yet, again, you look at what's happening here and how it's being reported, and it's really a situation where it couldn't be further from the truth. It really is Orwellian when we look at the reality on the ground in Iraq, or pick any other topic we want to talk about today and insert it. And you look at the reality and then how it's being reported, and it's truly Orwellian, and it's as though Hollywood got a hold of the situation, and it truly is the tail wagging the dog.
And let me quote a paragraph here from your introduction to the Project Censored book. Steadfast in its distortion of facts, the corporate press declares the exact opposite, that things in Iraq are far better than before, and that Obama is poised to bring home the troops. It is left to the gullible consumer of such quote-unquote news to reconcile it with the Obama administration's declared plans to have between 50 to 70,000 troops in Iraq until at least the end of his first term in 2013. And we heard the president suggest very explicitly in the West Point address on December 1st that Iraq is now a success story. And that's mainly based only on a single scoreboard, which is that the number of Americans who died dropped to an all-time low of 2 in the month of November of 2009.
Well, exactly. And if that's the benchmark that he would use, I would encourage him and members of his cabinet to send their families over to Baghdad to hang out for a few months and report back and let them know how life is in the great new American success story of Iraq. I mean, it's a travesty, and it's infuriating to me, and I know a lot of my colleagues who've reported from over there independently, to see what's happening on the ground, to know countless Iraqis that we've known and interviewed and worked with who've been either slaughtered or had to leave the country with their families altogether because it's just too dangerous for them to stay there. It's just really a travesty and infuriating to hear this propaganda and know what's really happening and see them able to continue to get away with it. And citing the whole situation in Iraq as some sort of a success story as a result of the surge, people that believe this are either deliberately misleading the general public if they're talking about it in that way, or they're just completely ignorant of the facts that the surge had nothing to do with drawing down the numbers of U.S. soldiers being killed there.
And Peter, Mickey, you have a comment?
It's the nationalist corporate frame of so-called news. I mean, that's why that these things aren't being reported. It's not that they're not true. It's not that there aren't people out there reporting these things. I mean, we get hundreds of stories every year at Project Censored from people like Dar and other, you know, great independent journalists doing this kind of work. And so it isn't that the stories aren't there. It's that the, you know, nationalist corporatist media has no interest in the truth or reporting news. They have to set an agenda that fits elite policies. Mm-hmm. And this is the real problem and crisis of the so-called free press in America.
That empire extension, the American empire, military-industrial media complex, is the interlocked corporate boards of directors, not only the media, the military companies, but the big banks on Wall Street as well. And so you have this empire of money spending, where we're spending more on the military, U.S. military, than the rest of the world combined, 1,000 bases worldwide, protecting not the American people, but protecting capital interests around the globe and the American capital investments around the globe. And that's the agenda that we have to talk about. That's the truth emergency that is right. It's the elephant in the room for every working person in this country.
Mm-hmm. And if I could rattle off a few numbers from research that Peter Dunn and Peter and I did a chapter in the book this year on the military media industrial empire. And, you know, in 2008 election cycle, Lockheed Martin gave $2.5 million in campaign contributions, less than half going to Democrats, but 49-51 was the split. Boeing gave $2.2 million. General Dynamics gave $1.6 million. Northrop Grumman gave over $20 million in 2008 in terms of lobbying influence. Raytheon spent $6 million. Why is Raytheon an interesting story? Well, because in the revolving door appointments of the Obama administration, William Lynn, Raytheon's senior vice president for government operations, was appointed to the number two spot at the Pentagon the day after Obama signed an ethics pledge saying he wasn't going to do that.
Right.
How's that for hope and change?
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of money we're up against. One of the stories in the top 25 this year was 151 members of Congress are actively invested in defense companies with over getting over $5 million worth of contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Other research that's been done shows the overlap, the symbiotic relationship between the military and the media. So we have the military media industrial complex between the New York Times and the Carlyle Group, between GE and Bechtel, Disney and Boeing and Halliburton, Gannett and Lockheed Martin. I mean, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And when you get that, you know, behind the curtain and you see what's going on, it should become more and more obvious to any critically thinking person. I mean, even on a rudimentary level, that the deck is not just stacked, the game is over.
And one of the tips of the iceberg that is visible to a television viewer is the advertising that some of these military contractors do. Now, they're not selling products to the general public. I'm not going to buy anything from Boeing or McDonnell Douglas, but they run commercials on television. And why? So that if you're working at CNN, you're not going to go deep on an investigation on those stories because you know that that's where part of your paycheck comes from, and you know that upper management is extremely sensitive about that.
You get ads from Lockheed Martin, you know, Carlyle thinking of, they all have PR firms. They all are putting out images about who they are, how wonderful they are. They're protecting the world, and they're in it for profit, and their profits are up massively.
Mm-hmm.
Lockheed Martin stock is up 300% since the beginning of the 9/11 wars. And, you know, so, and then Congress is invested in it. $200 million worth of investments from one out of four people in Congress in these companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's scandalous.
Yeah. And Dar, you published a powerful book in this past year called The Will to Resist. And you disclose that we have many soldiers who are in uniform who are very deftly avoiding conflict and combat and essentially duping their superiors. And that was a real eye-opener for me. And your book is the only place all year that I've seen that. Did you feel that you got any kind of meaningful coverage outside of the blogosphere and some of the independent left-leaning press about your important work?
No, that's the short answer and pretty much sums it up. I think so far of all the media I've done in this country, the biggest exposure I'll have is when C-SPAN airs on Book TV a tape of one of my talks about the book. That'll be about it. While conversely, if we go overseas, you know, I've thus far with the book been on Al Jazeera English two times. That's 130 million viewers each time, times two, and then a lot of other broader mainstream media overseas. So, you know, compared to what's here in the U.S., I mean, it's a very stark example of censorship. And I want to just point something out, too, just as another example of how the media covers things in this country and then chooses not to cover other things. Of course, we're all too familiar with the massacre at Fort Hood that occurred on November 5th by Sergeant Nidal Hassan, a Muslim, killing 13 troops and wounding dozens of others. But what we haven't heard, we've heard about that ad nauseum repeatedly since it happened, of course, focusing on his being a Muslim and possible terrorist ties, et cetera, et cetera. Well, let's look at some other stuff that's happened at Fort Hood. Since then, on November 22nd, as in this November 22nd, Killeen reports, police there reported two other deaths of soldiers killed by another soldier. One shot to death, one stabbed to death. Since that time, we've had other examples that, of course, escape the eye of reporting. Another one at Camp Lejeune on the East Coast, the big Marine base, that happened less than 12 hours after the Fort Hood massacre. We had another Marine there kill another Marine and then commit suicide when police showed up on the scene. More recently, on November 29th and 30th at upstate New York at Fort Drum, we had two other soldiers there murdered by another soldier, also from Fort Drum, both of them killed by multiple stab wounds. But we haven't heard about any of this in the mainstream press. Why? Because none of these guys are Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very powerful. Well, Dar, I want to thank you for joining us. And again, I commend you for the work that you do and appreciate the piece that you wrote. I invite people to read it in the new Project Censored Edition 2010. Dar Jamail, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to talk with you. So, gentlemen, I know I'm being ambitious here, but I would like to give our listeners a broad view of the stories that were censored, not properly covered in our media last year. And we'll go into a little depth on some of them, but my goal is to try to give people that overview so that they might be more inclined to read the book themselves and get the information that has been, for one reason or another, left out of corporate media coverage. So let's start with your top story. U.S. Congress sells out to Wall Street. And this relates to Matt Taibbi's reporting. He did a great job in Rolling Stone, and others covered this as well over at Truth Out. Greg Gordon wrote a great piece. And this is an evolving story because what we've learned is that while they try to identify only $700 billion, the so-called TARP money that has been pushed out to financial interests at the expense of the borrowers who really need relief, we actually know that that number is extremely low and that the true number is somewhere north of $13 trillion. Yet the media in this country doesn't delve into what the Fed has done, what the Treasury has done in assuming a lot of liabilities. And this is a very important story that also relates to the power of Goldman Sachs and the way its alumni are so influential in our economic policies and in these bailouts in particular.
Yeah, these are revolving door appointments. This is a long-standing problem in U.S. government, and it's not just in the banking industry. It's in the healthcare industry. It's in the military. It's in the media industry. This is, again, the sort of the it's the virus that infects the system and creates a pseudo-democracy or a veneer or an illusion of a democratic process. The first story this year, you know, it can be summed up in one very interesting question, you know, to give people a perspective about what it means to have this kind of power in Washington. What would you expect in return for $64 million? And what you would expect, of course, then is since 2008, give a little background, eight of the most troubled firms receiving the TARP money donated to congressional candidates, presidential candidates, both Obama and McCain. And which of these banks in particular are we talking about? Well, of course, everybody's going to know these names: Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, AIG, Fannie and Freddie, all them into the mix, throwing money left and right at people in Congress, especially people on the banking committees. Mm-hmm. I mean, so look, I mean, this is legalized bribery. I mean, this is, let's just call it what it is. There's no reason to tiptoe around. And by the way, this isn't just a Republican problem. This is something that goes back. I mean, this isn't just the Bush deal. You know, you have progressives and liberals and things like, well, this was Bush's bailout and Obama just picked it up. And, you know, what was he going to do? And but if you go back, this goes under Clinton, you know, the repeal of Glass-Steagall,
yep.
taking down the firewall there, you know, and Phil mm-hmm. Graham. So
and some of these same characters like Larry Summers, who's a top advisor to Obama. And Robert Rubin, who revolving doored out of the Treasury job back to Citibank. And he, if you look at the call logs of who Hank Paulson was talking to when the so-called crisis developed, it was all the same very tight-knit group of plutocrats.
Exactly.
All right, let's move on to number two. U.S. schools are more segregated today than in the 1950s, and this came out of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, and this is one that I think remains pretty well
secret. Not covered.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. I've been in communication with Gary Orfield, who was the professor that did this research, and some of the grad students down there. Usually when the Civil Rights Project puts out a press release, they get some coverage. In this case, their main message is that schools, particularly in the western states, are more segregated today than the South was in the 1950s, before the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, but it doesn't matter because we fixed all those problems. And
well, that's the message that the,
we have
the
a black,
frame...
We have a black president.
That's
so,
exactly
come on.
The frame that corporate media presents. That's exactly the frame that many people who are white like to think. But it's certainly not true.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that we have these vastly segregated, unequal school districts all over California, all over the western United States, where we have the dropout factories, literally, in inner cities, where we're putting young people out of school onto the streets in an economy that has no jobs for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then that helps increase the massive increase in the prison systems. And there's a focus, you know, police state literally on those communities, you know, arresting them for possession of marijuana. 800,000 people last year arrested for possession of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just an amazing, failure to cover the real structural problems of what are going on in this country, and racism being one of the most serious.
And part of it is that it doesn't fit the meme that affirmative action is evil. And that it's reverse discrimination, and therefore it all has to be dismantled. The problems have been fixed, and we are a colorblind society, just like Bill O'Reilly tells us. Mickey?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment entirely. And in fact, and we wrote about this in several of the other chapters on Infotainment Society, Junk Food News, you know, pseudo stories about the blackness of Barack Obama, or is Obama a racist, or Glenn Beck saying he's a racist and then 15 seconds later turning around and saying he never said that he was racist. I mean, that's another topic all in of itself, that psychoanalysis problem there of Glenn Beck. But
mm-hmm.
This issue that you touched on earlier as well is it shows the success of the propaganda of historical construction. I teach history at Diablo Valley College, and we'd go through the Civil Rights period. We go over these things, and a lot of the corporate produced textbooks, I mean, they're really strong about that. You know, they really go over the lessons of the '60s and Martin Luther King and all these things. And of course, that same narrative extends all the way through the presidency of Barack Obama, right? And so the idea is like, well, we've had all these movements and we've had all these things, and now we've had all these successes, so all the problems are over. So what's Gary Orfield talking about? Again, it's propaganda designed to prevent people from understanding the reality of a lot of people in this country, particularly people of color and poor people, who are continuing to struggle. They have not seen gains. They have not the promises of the '60s have passed them by, and it's again part of the serious truth emergency in our country.
Now, moving on to story number three, gentlemen, you know that I am a news junkie and I follow a lot of things as much as I can. And this was a real eye opener to me. This is a story that gives context to the rise of the Somali pirates. And on our TV screens, we often see these stories played out. And there was one earlier this year where President Obama gave the order for a sharpshooter to take out this pirate. And,
19-year-old kid.
It sounds like Hollywood, that this guy was able to fire a rifle and kill this guy at some distance as they're both bobbing up and down on boats, okay, on the open sea. And what we don't hear about is the history and the context and why Somali pirates are taking these actions. Peter, explain, please.
Well, this came from Al Jazeera English. It came from the Huffington Post, Wadneer News. And there's a history going back to 91 with the collapse of the Somali government that the people on the coast who primarily made their survival from fishing, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, without a Somali government, hundreds of fishing trawlers from nations all over the world are showing up in their waters, stealing hundreds of tons of their fish and shell food and that, and impoverishing even further the people in Somalia. So they're going out in boats and saying, you can't be here, don't tax us. They started taking weapons saying, get out, this is our water, these are our fisheries. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we see the beginning of big trawlers coming in, dumping toxic waste from Europe and other countries, nuclear waste, hospital waste, right into their waters, letting it sink. The tsunami stirs it up. You end up with radioactive isotopes on the beaches in Somalia. So the Somali pirates, which is a very bad name, are really the Somali Coast Guard, and that's how the people there see them, trying to protect them from this exploitation by foreign fisheries and toxic dumping in their where they live.
But doesn't the taking of ransom kind of change or color those intents and that background?
We don't, the ransom money is coming back to support the people in many cases.
And the ransom money is a pittance compared to the $450 million in seafood that were taken from Somali waters annually. I mean, so again, let's look at the whole frame. Let's blow mm-hmm. the frame up to the whole world, and let's really try to see what's going on here in full context. I mean, Somalia is not just a failed state. It was destroyed. It didn't just, like black hole or something. And this is something that is an ongoing crisis. And you mentioned Hollywood earlier, and it is. The whole term, the whole imagery of pirates, yeah. The whole R-Mady
business. Where's Johnny Depp?
Well, exactly. I saw the swashbuckling away. And you know who saves the day? It's the Navy SEALs, right?
Right.
The sharpshooting Navy SEALs killing Somali kids that are out there trying to
protect.
Not
just a job.
Oh, no. It's an adventure. And it's adventure on the high seas. And the same week that all this was going on, when they were saving the Vermont captain and the farmhouse and
right.
all that,
yeah.
The same week they were running through Congress an appropriations bill to help supplement special forces in the military, and they were pumping up the Navy SEALs and the corporate media, saying only a few people in the world could ever accomplish this kind of a great skill to save this captain, and on and on and on. So it's all totally connected. It's all rolled up, and it's all part of the frame. And it's also the same thing that Dar was saying earlier. There's all kinds of news about the tragedy of the death of American lives and American hostages. And I'm not saying that that's not tragic, but there's no reporting about, or there's no real frame placing quality or placing any real value to the lives of anyone else.
Mm-hmm. That's, oh, indeed. And that comes through loud and clear everywhere the U.S. Has a presence, that the life of an American is worth some factor much more than almost any other culture or nationality. Number four, nuclear waste pools in North Carolina. Jeffrey St. Clair at Counterpunch broke this story. And again, this is one that's widely underreported, and this was the first place that I saw this covered. Peter?
This is where in North Carolina there's a depository there. It's a Sharon Harris nuclear power plant for spent radioactive fuel rods. And they're just literally deposited there, circulated with cold water to keep them from continuing to ignite, literally. And this has been marked as one of the most vulnerable terrorist spots in the nation. If the cooling systems failed on these systems, millions of people, you would have a Chernobyl going on in North Carolina that could affect millions of people on the eastern coast. This is a highly dangerous concentration of radioactive isotopes and waste, all in one place. This mm-hmm. isn't spread around. It's not buried. It's literally exposed, And should that cooling system malfunction, a fire result would be unquenchable. You would have a nuclear meltdown of major proportions.
Mm-hmm. And a recent study by the Brookhaven Labs estimated that the pool fire, potential pool fire, could cause 140,000 cancers, contaminate thousands of square miles of land, and cause $500 billion in offsite property damage.
Well, and let's contrast this story being buried or just spiked altogether with the coverage that we're seeing about the next generation of nuclear power plants and how this is a response to climate change, that since there's no smokestack, that this, you know, we don't go into details about the problems of the waste. We don't acknowledge that every nuclear power plant is located near a body of water because of the cooling requirements and the superheating, the water that comes out of those plants, and that the Savannah River one time was reported to have a temperature of like 89 degrees.
You mean the climate change that isn't happening?
Well, but that the Savannah River thing is a result of a nuke facility, not climate change. But they're trying to sell us. And we have people like Stuart Brand, the Whole Earth visionary, who has now said that, well, because of climate change, he is supporting a selective expansion of nuclear power. Well, he's entitled to that view, but we have to put it in context with the real risks and with the sorry history of huge cost overruns that these facilities have experienced, and they want us to believe that next time it'll all be different. And whether we have a Yucca Mountain or not, the public doesn't need to worry. And, of course, we recently had an event at Three Mile Island that once again got people's attention, but it was mostly reported to me by Harvey Wasserman online, not through any corporate media outlet.
Yeah, and it's been 30 years since the first Three Mile Island incident. And you know what I was mentioning just a moment ago is it's interesting to me, at least, that some of the same people that are touting nuclear energy as at least some of the people that are touting the efficacy of nuclear energy to counter global warming are some of the same people that are saying climate change is a fraud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you can't build and continue to build nuclear power plants. It's like the person that buys their first motorcycle, and you know, and people will tell you, you know, it's not a matter of that you will or will not fall off, it's when, and so that capacity that we are going to see at some point major catastrophes around nuclear power plants, let alone the problem of the waste that will be with us for half a billion years.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a little offended by the motorcycle reference. I just gave away my motorcycle last year. But I have to acknowledge the truth of what you said. I dumped it twice over a 20-year period, and I have a broken thumb to show for it. And I have a friend who used to work in the Heart-Lung Transplant Center at Stanford, and they refer to two-wheeled vehicles as donor cycles.
Yeah. Well, it's not, you know, you can ride a motorcycle and you can be safe. But invariably, there's many people will fall. I have four guys in my men's group. We meet every Friday morning. Four of my motorcycles, and three of them have fallen.
Yeah. And well, also, I don't want to get too much into this, but other thing is that the drivers of automobiles and trucks don't see you.
I quit racing in my teenage years, so I figured it out sooner.
All right, story number five: Europe blocks U.S. toxic products. Now, we had coverage in this country of Chinese products that had lead, toys, and toothpaste, and all kinds of things, and that was the focus of consumer protection by the corporate media in this country in 2009, but not that our toxic products were being rejected elsewhere.
267 chemicals are regulated in Europe by the International Chemical Secretariat in Sweden. In other words, you can't bring those in products and sell them to Europeans, but you can to Americans. We only regulate less than a dozen. And so we have in lipstick mercury in electronics, lead in lipstick, endocrine disruptors and baby toys, all of that. In fact, our companies can make a product. They'll make the same. It looks the same. But the toxicity level that they sell in the U.S. will be different than what they sell in Europe. So, and countries around the world, including China, are able to sell products here that they can't sell in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this highly unregulated chemical industry that's selling things to the American public, and you don't know. I mean, you just can't tell from the product that you're holding in your hands or that you're drinking out of or that's in your living room, to what degree you're being exposed to very dangerous chemicals.
And one of the reasons suggested here in the piece is the industries affected contributed $35 million to federal election campaigns between in the 10 years between 96 and 2006.
There's that theme again that's come up in other stories and is going to come up in some of the other stories, you know. And just the last point, UC Berkeley researchers, School of Public Health, estimated over 40 billion pounds of chemicals entering into American commerce daily, and less than 500 of those, according to this report, was produced for the state of California, undergo any substantive risk assessments. So, I mean, it's just basically guinea pigs. We're just flooding the market with things. And later on, well, you know, the healthcare and HMOs, insurance companies are saying,
You guys, don't you understand what regulation does to businesses? Don't you see it's bad for the bottom line? It's bad for the overpaid executive salaries and the stock options?
And it's bad for the public.
Yeah.
Lack of.
Now, that segues perfectly into number six, which is about lobbying. And since your book was published, you know, there's been even more massive spending on lobbying in Washington. And it really is insidious, because when you see these front groups like Americans for Prosperity that then provide the guidance and the seed money for the yahoos who disrupted all the town hall meetings over health care in August and drove the message about death panels and socialism and escalating costs and all that, it's really, I mean, insidious doesn't quite do it justice, Peter.
This came from Open Secrets. This is the fact is that last year, in 2008, $3.2 billion was spent on lobbying inside the Beltway in D.C. That's $32,000 per day per member of Congress. I mean, that it's just a phenomenal amount of money. It's primarily coming from corporations or corporate-funded front groups. And that's what we're up against inside of democracy. So, you know, if you're on a delegation, and we went to see our congressperson 2 weeks ago with a peace activist did, you know, we're up against massive amounts of money that are flowing from the top down, from the big corporations into Congress, into lobbying, into trying to influence. Certainly the number one spender this past year was the health insurance companies, over $400 million. Their agenda, of course, is to make sure that Americans are required to buy health insurance from a private health insurance company instead of having it be a tax-subsidized health care for all, universal health care. That's their agenda. They're going to make more money off the proposed health care system that they're proposing even now in the Senate, which, you know, limits or may completely eliminate, once we see the end of it, any public option in terms of being supported, and protects those private insurance companies and their $30 billion a year profit from our premiums. That's just the top 10.
And lobbying in general, we're talking about, you know, doubling record amounts that are greasing the wheels of Congress. I mean, the exponential trajectory of money flooding into Washington from these interest groups, it's clearly skewing the system again away from public interests.
We're talking with Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips from Project Censored, and we're reviewing the stories that you didn't hear enough about or didn't hear anything about in the past year, particularly if your only sources are the corporate media in this country. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer for you. And they give us a little commission for every sale attributed to the Peter B. Collins Show. So, Peter and Mickey, we're now on to number seven, and I want to be brief on this story because Robert Perry was just on with us on a preceding podcast, and we talked in detail about Obama's military appointments, in particular Robert Gates, his defense secretary, the guy who was brought in to replace Rumsfeld. As Perry recently pointed out, Rumsfeld was fired because he sent a memo to Bush saying he wanted to pull troops out of Iraq. And that's inconsistent with liberals' view of Don Rumsfeld, but that is a fact. And he sent it the day before the election and was fired the day after the election. And Perry goes on to describe, as Melvin Goodman has, the real history of Gates. And it is really showing up in particular in this new policy toward Afghanistan.
So it was Robert Perry and Consortium News that gave us the lead on this story. And then we found other ones. Democracy Now! Had covered it, The Hill, and Global Research. But this was, you know, we look at the military empire that with the U.S. is continuing. We're seeing the same people being recycled back through the Obama administration. And Obama was the first president ever in American history to retain an opposing party's Secretary of Defense or War. I mean, so that basically says, hey, no policy change here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On to story number 8. Bailed out banks and America's wealthiest cheat IRS out of billions. Now, the focus has been on executive pay. And there have been some, I think, really tepid steps taken to rein that in. But we really don't see a lot of coverage about the tax dodges that have been set up by most major American corporations and how little they actually pay to the U.S. Treasury.
Well, 83 of the top publicly held corporations in the U.S. use tax havens overseas. And there's 30 different countries that will have banking laws that allow them to stash money there, draw interest on it, spend it some other way, no questions asked, secret kinds of things. So they're avoiding huge amounts of taxation. I mean, corporations will have other corporations overseas. They'll buy products from them so that that corporation overseas makes a lot more money and that they can write it off here. So there's all these tax dodges that big corps use, the transnational corporations use all the time. But the amounts that we're talking about are staggering. With offshore banking now harbors, just in individual wealth alone, $11.3 trillion. And that's a lot of American money out there. You know, the top 1%, the people mm-hmm. who own half this, literally half this country, they send their money overseas and they hide it. And so it becomes untaxable under our laws here.
And Peter, to your point about the bookkeeping and the multinational corporations, one of the things that bugged me and I kept screaming about when they told us just a year ago that we had to bail out Detroit, we could not permit General Motors to go into bankruptcy. It would end life as we know it. And so it turns out we've pumped more than $90 billion into Detroit over the past year. And we've never seen an honest appraisal of the books of these companies, because we know General Motors is profitable in Europe. We know that they have...
Profitable in Brazil, profitable
yes,
in Mexico.
South America yeah. and Central America.
Yeah.
And yet we have no way of knowing if that bailout money was compartmentalized into U.S. operations. What we do know is that they use taxpayer money to shut down plants, lay off workers, and contract their business, shut down dealers as well. And all of this is anti-competitive, and they say, well, it's the market. It's the market. Mickey.
And use money to fight against labor bills in Congress. I mean, and use the money they're getting to continue to fight against labor interests, which is another story. And, you know, in this story in particular, number 8, on the bailed out banks, if you look at Goldman Sachs, since, you know, we've been talking a little bit about Goldman Sachs and some of the other stories, we're talking about their tax rate dropping to 1%, from 34 to 1%. They got $10 billion in guaranteed debt guarantees from the U.S. government, mm-hmm. and they're only paying $14 million in taxes compared with $6 billion for 2007. I mean, that's astronomical. I'm sure a lot of Americans, if they could sign up to that kind of a program somewhere, they'd love to figure that out.
Well, we should have bought a bank, and then we could have gotten a bailout. Number 9, U.S. arms used for war crimes in Gaza. And this is a part of a bigger story where there is huge denial that continues today. And we've covered this in depth on the Peter B. Collins Show because I was just so deeply offended by the way Bush sat by and Obama was mute as the incoming president, as Israel kind of did a cleanup, a mop-up operation. 1,400 Palestinians were killed, 14 Israelis died, and most of those were soldiers. And this is a kind of a preemptive war that is based on the Bush Doctrine, and it was also heavily financed by the money that we give to Israel and by the arms that we sell to them.
Well, Israel was firing U.S.-made white phosphorus shells indiscriminately in densely populated areas of Gaza for those 3 weeks that they bombed Gaza. And, you know, the 1,400 people, some were burned to death by that phosphorus hitting their bodies and just being unable to extinguish it. I mean, a terrible death. And, you know, Human Rights Watch came out with a report in March of 2009 that this is war crimes. The Guardian, talked about suspending aid to Israel. Interpress talked about weapons facilitates killing in Gaza, U.S. weapons. I mean, so this was all over independent and foreign news. U.S., forget it. You just don't even talk about anything that Israel is doing in terms of human rights violations, or if it is. And then the Goldstone report that has come out clearly shows that, you know, there was a disproportionate attack, a disproportionate use of force, 1,400, you know, Palestinians killed, many, many more wounded, destructions of major parts of Gaza.
And despite the fact that Sir Goldstone is a Zionist Jew who insisted that the framing or the mandate to his commission include examination of war crimes by Hamas. And indeed, the report indicated that both sides were culpable, and yet Israel is in massive denial, and the U.S. Congress has joined in this denial, as Susan Rice, Obama's U.N. ambassador, invokes the Gitmo and torture mantra, which is, oh, we got to move forward, not look backward, all the way to January of this year.
Yeah, all the way to Election Day, which is when the Israelis had the onslaught going on.
Correct.
You know, so that's talk about, you know, smoke and mirrors over here. Hey, look over here, shiny object, election. Never mind what Israel's doing over there to the Palestinians. And then the corporate media proceeded to frame it as though it was only a Hamas attack situation. Mm-hmm. And you don't even need the Goldstone report. In February of 2009, the French press published an article called Israel Vows Disproportionate Strike on Hamas. That was published in France in the major French papers. What were the Americans looking at that week? They were looking at how the Olympic gold medal swimmer Michael Phelps got caught hitting a bong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
That was the big story in America. Over in France, it was Israel Vows Disproportionate Strike. And Goldstone basically said the same thing that the French papers said. Mm-hmm. But over here, it's all denial.
Yeah. And let's jump to number 11 because it ties in here. Private corporations profit from the occupation of Palestine. And this came from whoprofits.org, Palestine News Network, the Workers' World Newspaper, and commondreams.org.
Actually, it's Israeli corporations that will sell the cement, that will sell the materials to rebuild the buildings that were blown up by the Israeli military.
Yeah.
So there's a profit-making motive here. Israel International Corporations are involved, that are involved in the occupation. They're providing, they fuel corporate interests. So real estate deals, the infrastructure, the whole wall, all the walls and roads and everything, there's a profit being made by corporations inside of Israel. And oftentimes where U.S. money is spent that enriches the Israelis at the cost of the destruction that's happened in Palestine.
Yeah, yeah. It's breathtaking, and it's just amazing that there aren't any reporters in this country or news outlets that think that those are viable news stories and important things for Americans to know.
You can be an American citizen and donate to an Israeli nonprofit that's building settlements on the West Bank. And, you know, which are illegal, but you can have it as a tax deduction on your income tax.
Wow. Next, let's go to South America and talk about stories 10 and 18 in the censored 2010 top 25 list. And the first is Ecuador declares foreign debt illegitimate. This was covered at Alternet, and somebody put up a story on YouTube about it as well. And frankly, I think I saw about a 3-inch story one day in the New York Times about it.
Ecuador completely restructured their foreign debt. They went back and looked at how many these were U.S. banks and where they'd borrowed, and where there had been bribery and illegal acts that had gone on inside a government. And they said this debt is illegal. They've already paid more in interest than the original amount of the debt anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So they renegotiated with the banks and they wiped out 2/3 of their debt. This isn't covered in the corporate media because they don't want other countries to get this idea that they can do that. I mean, you know, this is the economic hitman story of illegal loanings and corruption inside of governments all over the world. And then the people have to pay on this debt forever. Correo and their government said, no, we're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been really looking at, they're part of the Bolivarian Revolution, with this part of Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, throughout South America, that is benefiting the people in those countries, that there's a real, you know, democratic movements. These people, Correo, Hugo Chavez, are all being elected by two-thirds of the population. So this is very democratic. It's very open. It's very, very upfront. And they're rebuilding their constitutions. And part of that was this getting rid of the foreign debt. But also in their constitution, they're saying that there's a constitutional right. Nature has a constitutional right to exist, which is saying that the oil companies and the exploitation in the Amazon and other places, Ecuador has actually put massive amounts of land in the Amazon as a reserve, even though there's oil there. They're not going to sell it off to the oil companies.
Well, after the experience with Texaco and Chevron's denial of its obligations to clean up the mess, you can understand this.
They're even trying to put a constitutional amendment through in regards to media, that private media, if it doesn't benefit the people, doesn't have all the rights that they're claiming they should have, that there should be a benefit to the people in terms of how media is run and controlled. And they're trying to add, they're negotiating that right now inside their in terms of their constitution. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing some major kinds of changes that are very democratic, very much designed to improve human betterment for the country as a whole, and putting these as constitutional amendments.
Very interesting.
Yeah, Article 1 in the Rights of Nature Clause states, quote, every person, people, community, or nationality will be able to demand the recognitions of rights for nature before the public organisms. The application and interpretation of these rights will follow the related principles established in the Constitution. And they're citing this in lawsuits against the mining companies.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that is really happening.
And we continue with the countdown, the recap of the top 25 censored stories from the last year. They are recounted in Censored 2010. And the editors of the project, Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff, continue with us. We're joined by Brad Friedman, a regular contributor to the Peter B. Collins Show for many years, as we've covered election integrity issues. And Brad is responsible for in-depth reporting. And we also want to credit Larissa Alexandrovna, our friend over at rawstory.com, who also delved deeply into the mysterious death of Mike Connell. And he was the IT consultant to Republicans and to Karl Rove in particular, was front and center on the technology during the 2004 election, which I believe was stolen in Ohio. And then he died in a plane crash in Ohio. This was something that was briefly reported in the corporate media, but they really didn't go into any depth on what his role had been and on the implications of his death. And the story has advanced quite a bit since then. Brad Friedman, first of all, kudos on the work that you've done, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Great to be here. Good to talk to you, Peter.
Give us a little background for people who haven't followed our coverage about who Mike Connell was and why his death was significant.
Well, Mike Connell was really at the center of the, certainly the Ohio, 2004 Ohio election night results reporting system. He essentially created that website, and we had a few strange anomalies where in the middle of the night, suddenly the reporting on the Ohio election results, as the country was waiting on the edge of their seats to see what was going to happen in this state, which would decide the presidency, suddenly the election results system in Ohio moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee, for some reason. Now, the Ohio says, J. Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State at the time, says it was because the system got overloaded and it moved to this server down in Tennessee. Suddenly, when it came back up, what do you know? George W. Bush had won. Now, there's a lot of questions about that, and that server down in Tennessee was the same one that ran GeorgeWBush.com, the RNC website, GW43.com. So this was a far-right website, and that in and of itself was strange. But Connell was in the middle of not just the Ohio election results in Ohio, but he was also inside Congress, having created the firewall for Congress for committees like the Judiciary Committee and so forth. So there was a lot of questions. He was being deposed to answer some of those questions when about a year ago, to this day, really.
It was December 22nd, right around Christmas.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Uh-huh. Until about a year ago to this day, he was on his way home in a solo plane flight back to Ohio when he suddenly went down in flames. We're still waiting for the NTSB report on that. It should be due really any time, trying to figure out exactly what happened and why this experienced pilot suddenly went down when the weather was said to be just fine.
Yeah. And the other critical point here is that he was sitting for a deposition in a lawsuit brought about the 2004 election in Ohio just the day before our election in 2008. And we don't know exactly what the ramifications of that were in terms of any change of plans the Republicans might have had to try to repeat their feats from the past. But that is, I think, an interesting factor and should be mentioned. Now, additionally, Larissa Alexandrovna drew some criticism from Mike Connell's widow and people who were reporting on this in Akron at the time. But since then, Mrs. Connell has come forward and asked for an investigation. Is that true?
Yeah, there are concerns about from both Mrs. Connell and Mike Connell's sister, both of whom are now kind of concerned about what happened and the questions that have come up since, some various tips that we have received, still vetting on how legitimate they are or aren't. But they have said that, you know, they'd like to see a real investigation here, and if there's information that there was foul play, they'd be interested in bringing a wrongful death suit against folks like Karl Rove. Oddly enough, by the way, after Mike Connell died, for such an important guy in the GOP, I'm unaware of any statements that were given by George W. Bush, by Karl Rove, upon his death, which in and of itself is a sort of an odd red flag. So there's a lot of red flags out there, and a lot of people are calling for an investigation. We'll wait for that NTSB report and see what they have to say about it and see where things go from there.
Well, Brad, I really appreciate your contribution here, and as you know, I have a great deal of respect for the work that you've done at bradblog.com. You really are the leading journalist covering election issues in this country, and we continue to have questions come up, including this special election in New York State that was conducted about a month ago with some very serious shortcomings there.
Indeed. As I've always said to you on your show, these aren't matters of right and left. These are matters of right and wrong. And where the Conservative Party candidate up there in the New York 23 race seems to have been screwed, if you will, by these new Sequoia, untested Sequoia voting machines, there's a lot of questions that need to be answered. So we will stay on the case as ever. And let me just toss in, by the way, as long as you got Mickey and Peter on as well, I'm delighted and honored to have been awarded an award from the Project Censored folks and to have contributed a chapter to their book on the election 2008 mess. A lot of people think, oh, everything worked out just fine.
Right.
Read the book. You'll find out otherwise. All kinds of nightmares all over the country that still have not been corrected by the Democrats, by the Republicans, or anybody else. We still have very serious concerns about election integrity in this country, and we need to fix them, correct them, before they come back to bite us in the butt big time, as we've seen over the past two out of the three presidential elections, in any case, in the past.
Indeed. Brad Friedman, thank you for joining us today. Always great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, my friend.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, it's let's move on here to story number 13 in the Project Censored report. And this is a story that was broken by A.C. Thompson. And he's a very interesting guy who also was co-author of a book called Torture Taxi about the rendition of so-called terror suspects to other countries for the purpose of torture. This story, though, is about the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and the racism that was that has surfaced in many of the issues of the Reconstruction. Peter?
This is a report in The Nation magazine. It was on Democracy Now! That we know now that white vigilante groups were patrolling the streets and in New Orleans, supposedly protecting their neighborhoods, that at least 11 African-American people were shot and killed. There's been no investigations as to legitimacy or even the murders of these people. It's a shocking example of overt racism and, on par with lynchings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's also what I was alluding to, which is not really part of this story, is the way the Reconstruction has benefited whites to the detriment of African-Americans, particularly in the lower ninth.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The lack of public housing, the whole school system, everything's been transformed, and an attempt to kind of restructure the ethnicity of New Orleans and the neighborhoods that were highly black, that those people are spread all over. It changes the politics in the city,
mm-hmm.
and has a major impact in terms of the working poor.
Yeah,
and the purging of blacks in New Orleans was very clear on the in the corporate media. How anytime African Americans were shown wading through water trying to survive, they were referred to as looters. And anytime whites were shown doing the same things, they were survivors.
And heroes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Story 14, we've pretty well touched on. Congress invested in defense contracts. I think we'll let that one stand in the interest of time. Number 15, World Bank's carbon trade fiasco. And this is something I don't know much about. Peter, you want to take this one?
The World Bank is helping the broker carbon emission trading agreements by loaning money to corporations who are buying up massive amounts of land. There's literally a land-grabbing operation going on in the world. And a lot of times these are farmlands indigenously owned by people that the governments are selling out from under them, literally. And so farmland becomes corporatized. And you can put up a eucalyptus forest for pulp mill and then trade that the benefits of those trees growing as a carbon trade-off for a corporation that's polluting somewhere in the world and make money off of it. So the bank helps do that, and it undermines indigenous farming worldwide, and it sort of maximizes the profit of mass plantations and corporatized farming. And not only controlling wood, fuel and wood and the whole of this carbon trading industry, but food as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that we just don't understand or see the implications of inside this country.
Yeah, very interesting. Number 16, U.S. repression of Haiti continues. And this was first reported at Haiti Liberté. And has also shown up at Upside Down World. And Haiti is a country that Americans find pretty easy to forget.
We've been occupying literally either U.S. or now NATO troops, pretty much under U.S. guidance, supporting the policy, the elites inside of Haiti against, the whole democracy movement that had been there. I mean, Aristide was elected president twice, both times with the help of the U.S. He was undermined and kidnapped literally out of his own home,
mm-hmm.
4 years ago by American forces. And in place now is this continued repression so that literally DynCorp is building a police training facility right in the middle of Cité Soleil. And so there continues to be killings, disappearances, and a repression of democratic movements inside of Haiti.
Yeah, and the Obama administration did not distinguish itself in the handling of the coup in Honduras, which is still playing out with a dubious election, and essentially we seem to have just acceded to the architects of the coup. And the interest that took out the Zelaya government.
The Zelaya government, they were talking about doing some of the constitutional changes, part of the Bolivarian revolution movements that had happened in other countries, in Ecuador, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, Brazil. Mm-hmm. They were just starting to talk about it, maybe have an opinion poll about it. Did the people want to do that? And we know fully that the U.S. was totally, you know, in negative on that and supported that coup, has manipulated Zelaya out, and, you know, now there's an election that's half the country's boycotted. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, that ongoing counter efforts by U.S. interests, both in El Salvador, Honduras, and Colombia now, where we've expanded military bases right on the border of Venezuela. So, you know, there's this... clearly, our involvement there is quite serious, and we're dividing the, you know, countries that the elites still control against the populist movements that are going on in terms of the Bolivarian revolutions inside of South America.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty sad. Number 17, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, facilitates a U.S. covert war in Sudan. This came from Interpress Service. That is where Dar Jamail distributes a lot of his coverage, and also shows up at dissidentvoice.org, the Black Star News, and San Francisco Bay View, written by Keith Harmon Snow. Tell us about this.
Well, Sudan's an Sudan is an hour discussion in itself, but it boils down to the fact that that Chevron used to control the oil fields along the coast in the Sudan. Now the Chinese are running them, and we don't like that. And there's oil in Darfur as well. So by indicting the president of Sudan through the ICC, International Criminal Court... Which we don't participate
right,
in,
right.
Exactly.
We refer people to them, but we don't feel bound by the ICC.
We
won't sign the treaty.
And this whole effort of save the Darfur, which has become the sort of populist, you know, saving people from genocide effort. And there's been serious massacres on both sides there, but it really has to do with the geopolitical power structures of oil and control. And we our agenda, quite clearly laid out 10 years ago by the Project for New American Century, is to contain China's growth as best as we can. They will exceed us economically in the next generation, and controlling their growth means controlling their access to oil. And so as we look around the world, the hot spots, Iran, China buys oil from Iran, mm-hmm. Somalia, China's getting oil from Somalia. Venezuela. China's trading oil and getting oil from Venezuela. Those are some hot spots where we're painting these pictures of negativity about those countries. In reality, what we're talking about really is geopolitical oil fights worldwide, which is a whole lot about what Iraq and Afghanistan are about.
Indeed.
Essentially.
Yeah. We're going to pass on number 19 because we alluded to it earlier. Bank bailout recipients spent money to defeat labor. Let's move on to number 20 because I think this is a critical story about the commission that managed the presidential debates in 2008. Because in particular, I believe that the networks predominantly steered the debates to their cable channels so that they would not be directly regulated by the FCC rules that cover broadcast stations. And so we saw these debates where questions were used to ridicule Dennis Kucinich. Dirt on Mike Gravel's bankruptcy was introduced that had nothing to do with the issues that he had put forward. And just in the face time given to the various candidates, it was grossly unequal and incredibly apparent. And yet these were seen as the fora where we as the citizens were supposed to get information about these primary candidates and who would be the party nominees. Mickey?
Well, what a lot of people don't realize in this country is that, you know, it's not just the corporations that are controlling things through lobbying and so on. Since 1987, there's a private corporation of Republicans and Democrats called the Commission on Presidential Debates that, you know, basically controls the contracts for the debates, who gets in, who doesn't. We all remember the spectacle of Ralph Nader being uninvited after he met the minimum requirements, and they changed the rules in the middle of the sort of the game there. Mm-hmm. And then they threatened him with arrest if he even came to sit in the audience legitimately. I mean, that's the kind of fear of in control here that we're talking about. And you mentioned just a minute ago the way that the corporate media framed how certain candidates were serious or not serious or winnable or not. I mean, they basically decided who was going to be a viable candidate. And it wasn't just in the Democratic Party where we saw that happening with because people like Kucinich, but it was also the Republican Party we had with Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that the same time the corporate media was talking about Rudy 9/11 Giuliani, America's mayor, was the dark horse and he was the winningest candidate and he was going to come out. At the same time, Ron Paul was either equaling him in the polls or outpacing him, and they simultaneously would say Ron Paul is a joke. He does not have a chance to win, but Giuliani is still somehow the strong candidate. I mean, so we have direct evidence that the corporate media was trying to select candidates and say who was going to win and who wasn't going to win. And then that doesn't even get involved with what was actually happening at the debates when we had, you know, behind the scenes kind of deals or secret deals as to what the rules of the debate will be. I mean, this is just preposterous. I mean,
wasn't there one case when John Edwards was still in the race where he and Hillary and a third party were caught on a live microphone kind of saying, well, God, can't we get these yahoos off the stage?
Right. Exactly. I mean, so the truth comes out at strange times when they don't know the mic is on.
Yeah.
It's too bad that the truth doesn't come out more often. But and not to mention, you know, we've got the beer companies and the tobacco companies. I mean, they've been sponsoring and skewing American elections all the way back to the 1800s. Maybe not the same companies, but same kind of interests. I mean, people might wonder why St. Louis is always in the mix of the presidential debates. Well, you can ask Anheuser-Busch about that corrupt influence as well.
Peter?
I think this gets framed, really. And I noticed something. This was like a year before the election was even beginning. So this would have been 3 years ago, actually. And there was a big piece from the Washington Post about policies in China and the U.S. position towards policies in China. And it said, well, we've consulted with party leaders from both parties in regards to this. And who did they pick? McCain and Hillary. And I mean, when I saw that article, I go, okay, this is how it's getting shaped out. And I think that was clearly true. I think Obama made a big difference, and it was certainly a tight race. And if you read Brad Friedman's chapter, there's a whole lot of interesting stuff that went on around the voting machines.
New Hampshire?
New
Hampshire was very questionable.
But here, you know, you have this private corporation that both parties are involved in that runs the presidential debates, establishes the questions, and gets to set the rules as to who gets to be on the debate.
And there were so many important issues that were never raised. I don't recall anything about wiretapping. I don't recall anything about the torture policies.
Habeas corpus?
Yeah. I mean, critical issues, and they were talking about driver's licenses for undocumented people, which is not a federal issue. They were talking about Charlie Gibson's capital gains tax problems, but they weren't addressing the interests of the American people, and that came through loud and clear. Story 21, recession causes states to cut welfare. And this is, of course, there was just a story that shows that one in eight American families are now receiving food stamps in this country. And number one, there's a denial of the abject poverty that is quite prevalent in this country. And there is the myth that the Clinton welfare reform both worked and was good for us.
Absolutely false. We've been increasing poverty yearly. We're up to 40 million people officially poor. There's probably another 20 to 30 million that are borderline, barely getting by, miss a paycheck, and you're on the street, literally. We know homelessness is up. We know the food banks are feeding more people. And the states, in order to balance their budgets, particularly under the TANF program, the welfare reform program that Clinton put in place, are trying to get people off. We've seen a 40% decline in families being able to participate in welfare since 2001. And in some states, like Georgia's, had a 90% drop. So thousands of families are being pushed into the street, literally, or into these, you know, dreading minimum wage kinds of jobs, double, you know, job sorts of things for working women with kids. It's horrendous, and you know, the whole safety net in this country has literally been undermined for poor people.
But it's inconsistent with the media-generated view of America. And so we give it short shrift, and you don't see poor people on TV.
No.
Television is just filled with people who have every consumer item they want. They have no money cares. And that's what we're all supposed to believe is the depiction of the average American family.
Yeah, or some way they're criminals. Or they're gang members, or they inner city. It's their fault.
Right.
You know, it's like their fault that they're poor.
Yeah, it goes back to, the so-called Protestant work ethic ideal of the 19th century in this country, where, rags to riches going up is the story for everyone. And if it doesn't happen to you, it's totally your fault. And the places we do see the poor are when they're being ridiculed or marginalized or victimized or being shown as though exactly what Peter said, it's just their fault somehow. And if we extrapolate from this story, number 21, and we look at this, one question obviously is where do these people then go to turn for help? And of course, the prison system maybe has answers for that, and certainly the military has answers for that. One group in our society, one institution that seems to be doing very well lately is the military in terms of recruiting. The Army's met their recruitment levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's trillions of dollars for bank bailouts, trillions of dollars for war, but suddenly we don't have any money for health care, and we don't have any money to help needy citizens and starving people and people that are going to bed hungry in our own country, not to mention the crumbling infrastructure.
Yeah. I heard, I was listening to the Rush Limbaugh program. Oh, no, it was Sean Hannity. They do run together. The other day, and he took a call from a woman in Texas who said that the reason people are unemployed is that they don't have personal responsibility and that they don't have the proper work ethic. And at a time like this, when bailouts lead to bonuses for bankers who ran companies onto the rocks, and the ripple effect is, sharply decreased employment in this country. The real number is somewhere around 20%.
And record foreclosures.
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's not personal responsibility or a lack of some sort of initiative and drive.
That is the structural maintenance of a surplus labor force to drive wages down. That's exactly what it is.
Very good point. Number 22, Obama's trilateral commission team, and this came from AugustReview.com. And just briefly, I'll tick off the names of people in the administration who are members of this commission. Timothy Geithner, Susan Rice, James Jones, the National Security Advisor, and his deputy, Thomas Donilon. We know Paul Volcker, the senior economic advisor to the president. Dennis Blair, the National Intelligence Director. Kurt Campbell, Assistant Secretary of State. Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg. Richard Haass at State. Also Dennis Ross and Richard Holbrooke. Now, what the hell is the Trilateral Commission, and how do you become a member? I thought this was something that kind of faded back in the 1980s sometime.
Well, it's been around since 73. It was originally founded with Rockefeller's money. It comprises the top corporate people from the United States, Europe, and Japan in an international planning group, where they do studies to continue to support the expansion of capitalism and free market economies. There's only 400 members. There's only 80-some U.S. members. So to end up with 12 people in the Obama administration out of those 80 is a very tight network of people at the highest policy levels of international capital. And, they know each other. They know these other people around the world, part of the transnational corporate class, and it's a clear demonstration that these networks of power, the Bilderberger Group and the Trilateral Commission and those, are not only dominate governments worldwide, but are the chosen ones to be placed inside of administrations. And Obama's, did exactly the same thing. This was under the advice of Zabrinsky. Zabrinsky, of course, was in the Carter administration. Carter was a trilateralist, as was Bill Clinton. In fact, the only high-level person in the State Department who isn't a trilateralist is Hillary Clinton, but her husband,
who's
of course,
married
is.
To Bill.
Mickey?
And Brzezinski is one of Obama's chief foreign policy advisors.
Yeah.
He wrote the Grand Chessboard a number of years ago. I mean, people want to really take a look at what Obama's policy is. I mean, go back and look at what Brzezinski was saying.
Well, and he's responsible for our original presence in Afghanistan.
Right, in the Carter years.
Yep, and drawing in the Soviets.
And the Mujahideen.
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a different crew of people than the neocons. The ones that came out of the Heritage Foundation,
right,
and the Hoover Institute and that were the Bush administration's top-level officials, but they all know each other. They belong to the same country clubs, and they're on the same planning groups. And so, you know, you have one element of the American elite policy groups now in the Obama administration, many sometimes the same faces, but it's the same policies. Mm-hmm. And very little structural change, and we see a worsening for working people and a continuation of a global policy and a foreign policy that is imperialist. Yeah. and has an agenda of military domination of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is two sides of the same global dominance coin. You've got, on the one hand, the neocons and rebuilding America's defenses from 2000 with the Project for a New American Century, and you've got Brzezinski and the Grand Chessboard. You know, so if you want a quick primer on global dominance, you can get it pretty quickly.
Yeah. Moving now to story number 23, activists slam World Water Forum as a corporate-driven fraud. The World Water Forum was held in Turkey in March of 2009, and that's about as much as I know about it.
Well, you know, you think, oh, World Water Forum, they're going to be helping us out environmentally protecting water, and that is not true at all. It's an attempt to privatize water distribution in the world. And the Suez Environmental and Viola Environmental Services are the two biggest private water corporations. And there's a number of other ones like Bechtel that are involved and engaged as well. And part of it is treating water and delivering water privately instead of through government services or a democratic process as a human right, but to sell it and make money off of it. And it's not just putting it in bottles, but it's controlling whole water systems and watersheds and the privatization of water rights and who owns the water coming down the rivers and that is a human, that's a human history right. I mean, the water was there, we used it. Now that is part of this global privatization effort.
That's amazing, because it certainly is a natural resource that is part of the commons and doesn't even know borders, much less property rights.
Yeah, I like that you said the commons, and that's something that we could talk about for quite a while. And in fact, former associate director of Project Censored, Andy Roth, in chapter 14 of the 2010 book this year, wrote a whole chapter, Water as Commodity or Commons, and those issues from the 2009 World Water Forum, that really goes into this in depth. And I know Peter just mentioned Bechtel, and we all remember Bechtel in Bolivia and the Bolivian people standing up and saying, no way are you going to take our right to life away. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about life here. We're talking about water. You need it to live. And the lesson was clear there, too, because when Bechtel actually did leave, they had to pay a huge fine. The people of Bolivia ended up paying a fine to the WTO.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Story 24, dollar glut finances U.S. military expansion. And this came from Global Research, written by Michael Hudson.
Michael's won awards from us before. He's a great economist, a really good researcher. And what he's saying is that partly because oil is purchased in dollars in the world, that banks have to keep. China has $2 trillion. Saudis have $2 trillion. You know, these countries keep massive amounts of dollars, and they'll put them in treasury bonds. And the treasury bonds, of course, are helping finance the war. And that capacity, how the dollar, literally out there in terms of protecting the U.S. dollar, that's what the military empire is about. And the
many people have suggested that the recent wars have been in part triggered by the threat that petro producers would break away from the dollar and adopt the euro.
That's what Saddam Hussein was doing.
Saddam Hussein did it 3 years before in Iraq, and the first thing we did after we occupied that country was switch Iraq back to selling oil in dollars. But Robert Fisk wrote about 6 weeks ago a piece where he was saying that China and Russia and India have been meeting privately to really talk about the transition away from the dollar as a total oil trade mechanism in the world, and to be able to use the yen or the yuan and other resources, the euro in particular. And if that happens, then we would see, you know, trillions of dollars flooding back to the U.S. The price of Walmart would double in just almost immediately. We could see hyperinflation, and that's the real risk that we're trying to, you know, that the U.S. is trying to prevent.
And this is, of course, why we have 130 military bases. Military bases in 130 countries all over the world.
Right.
So, I mean, that military-industrial complex, I mean, these things are all connected together. And, you know, by the way, I just wanted to mention very quickly that all of the stories are available online at projectcensored.org, and people can see them all.
Great. We will talk a little more about the website in a moment. And some people didn't think it was possible, but we have reached story 25. And by the way, podcasts are beautiful because you don't have to listen to it all at once. So while you're exercising or driving, feel free to listen to this in parts and capture as much information as you can. Number 25, fast-track oil exploitation in the Western Amazon. And this is PLOS one. I don't know that source there. August of 2008. Written by Matt Feiner and company. Also showed up in The Guardian UK. And this ties in a little bit with what we were talking about earlier about Ecuador and its desire to constitutionally protect its natural resources.
Or portions thereof. There's certainly a fight in Ecuador as to what extent they're going to allow oil exploitation in their portions of the Amazon, Bolivia, Brazil, a number of countries involved here. But we're seeing this real expansion of oil rigs and pipelines and vast swaths of the most biologically diverse regions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that there's at least 35 multinational oil companies now operating over 180 oil and gas blocks, big blocks of land where they're doing oil exploration, development, and expansion. Some of these have been massively contaminating, and the people that live there have been violently, literally violently, repressed and faced, you know, kind of an ecological disaster in terms of their ways of life. So this is one of the hot spots in the world right now in terms of that issues of environmental versus, you know, oil and gas development. And it's clearly it's in our top 25. You know, we picked 25 stories, and this is like ranked 25th. That doesn't mean it's not important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're picking these stories from thousands. And so that process, and there's 9 universities engaged in this process in this book. We're hoping to see double that in the next year's volume.
Mm-hmm.
And so that universities are doing the job of validating independent news stories worldwide. And we think there's a very important role for universities to play.
Yeah.
And that process is, we call it validate independent news.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have a website now where universities are posting stories all year round, of saying this is a valid news story, where a professor in the field will look at it and say, yep, looks like a valid news story to me. And so that process, we feel, is vital, given the capacity, the incapacity of corporate media that do it, giving us top-down news, propaganda news from the top, that we have to support and expand independent news sources and news stories from the bottom up, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that universities have a role to play in that capacity worldwide.
And Peter mentioned the ranking of the stories, because that's certainly something that people ask about a lot. Like, well, what, this story seems more important than that, and so forth. And so, again, the ranking isn't so much which is more or less important. In fact, not online, but in the 2010 book, you can see Censored 2010's honorable mentions.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the whole list of stories that were really close. And, you know, again, you go through them and you say, wow, that's just a really important story, whether it's demining stopping in Lebanon, you know, the Israeli mining, over a million cluster bombs that Israel dropped throughout Lebanon there, Cuba being used. Years ahead of the Eat Local movement, military corporate legacy of Obama's Secretary of Education.
Arnie Arneson?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you could do a whole show on that and schools and the charter schools and militarization of schools in Chicago.
Yeah.
Guantanamo, worse since Obama takes over. Latin American leaders refute the U.S. drug war. You got another story. A constitution-free zone for two-thirds of the U.S. population, ACLU report. Fault lines intersect a nuclear plant near New York City. That sounds like something you'd think people would be very interested in learning about.
I would, yeah.
So, I mean, these stories go on and on. Coal versus wind in West Virginia. Air Force embraces coal. On and on.
That's clean coal.
I'm sorry.
You're not using the right terminology.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I haven't been successfully programmed by the corporate media, but I'll go home and watch as much as I can.
Okay. Well, and I want to mention the Project Censored website, because you have an RSS feed that people can subscribe to and get an email with information that's just been posted there. And there's a range of resources here of independent news sources, a whole lot. So that's projectcensored.org. And before we close, gentlemen, Peter Phillips, are passing the baton to Ben Frymer, who will be the new director of Project Censored. Tell us a little bit about Ben and what kinds of things might be reshaped under his direction.
Well, we're in our 34th year of doing research on independent news stories. Part of that in the recent years, kind of preceding even thinking about this, was the truth emergency efforts that we started to say, hey, we got a very serious problem. This is global. Ben Frymer is a PhD out of UCLA. He's a sociologist. He teaches in liberal studies at Sonoma State. He was a natural person to hand over the annual production of the Censored Yearbooks, where we're selecting the 25 most important news stories, write that book. It's a huge amount of time to do that. I've been doing it for 13 years, and so I'm ready to really kind of move on to other things. And Mickey and I are really going to engage in this truth emergency effort and putting that message out worldwide, but engaging and trying to get universities to assist and do this kind of work as well. And we think that's a really important step to continue. So we're not disengaging at all, but we're really expanding through our foundation, which is called Media Freedom Foundation, and support of Project Censored. That's our number one goal. And so we'll continue to see the Project Censored program at Sonoma State in cooperation with other universities nationwide. And Ben will be the key person behind that, leading that effort and doing the annual book. And Mickey and I are going to be off promoting this whole truth emergency and validated independent news.
Great.
And you can see the more of the work that Peter and I are doing at we have several offshoot websites now from Project Censored. We have a great webmaster, Adam Armstrong, who's developed and updated a lot of our websites. We now have the PNN, Personal News Network, news feeds right on the right-hand side. So when people say, where do you get your news? Where do you get your information? We have a whole list of independent news sources there that Peter had mentioned earlier. RSS feeds every day, 50 or more news stories a day coming in there. Independent news analysis on the PNN site for Media Freedom Foundation. We have a blog, dailycensored.com, so people can actually be blogging about these things all the time. We are looking for writers and people to contribute all the time. And also, the mediafreedominternational.org website is the website that's housing the validated independent news that Peter had mentioned earlier, and investigative reports done by professors, by students, researchers, etc., that are all addressing the issue of the global truth emergency.
And as you have just described, all the range of work that you're doing, it's all centered on the fundamental issue that people deserve information unfiltered, unbiased, and unspun. And the more we can get that message out there and get people to fight for it, the better off we'll all be.
It's the only way we'll save democracy. It's the only way we'll have democracy, is to have that kind of open, transparent information available to all of us.
One final question. The state of California has sharply reduced the funding for its university system. Has that trickled down to Project Censored?
Project Censored doesn't get funding from the state of California. We have an office. We can use the internet. So in that sense, there's some secondary funding, but our staff, students have a instructionally related activity fee on our campus. That's part of our funding. But most of our funding comes from sale of our book annually, from donors who come on our website and make a donation and or sign up to get our emails. And, you know, every 6 months we're going to send it's time to send us $25 kind of thing. And that's the bulk of how we raise the $150,000 a year that we need to even continue this work.
All right.
And so, you know, we're hanging in there.
Great. Well, I hope people will get involved in every way they can at projectcensored.org and pick up a copy of the new publication, Censored 2010. That's what we've talked about today, the top 25 censored stories of the past year. My thanks to Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Gentlemen, great job.
Thank you. Thank
we
you.
Did it. All 25. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Keep looking for the truth.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds?